In letter 10, we outlined Rav Hirsch's approach to the categorization of the mitzvos, and we mentioned six categories. And as we begin letter 11 now, we are going to focus on the first three of those categories, Toros, Mishpatim, and Chukim. And the way we're going to do this is we're going to examine each one separately. So, for example, we're going to see Toros first. We are going to see how Dayan Grunfeld explains the mitzvah in the introduction to Chorev, and then we're going to see it inside, and as Rav Hirsch gives examples, we'll hopefully look at the different psukim, at least some of them, that he quotes to get a good idea of what, for example, Toros represents. Then we'll do the same with Mishpatim and with Chukim. So let us begin our discussion of Toros. Now, Dayan Grunfeld says that Toros are meant to motivate us to live the right kind of life. He says that they are truths that are the same as knowledge. You can find Dayan Grunfeld's explanation of Toros in the introduction to Chorev, which we're going to see inside now. As far as the term Toros is concerned, it can without difficulty be applied to the general religious truths of Judaism, because the word Torah, although sometimes used for the whole corpus of the laws, originally signifies teaching or doctrine. Furthermore, Rav Hirsch understands the root of the word Torah to be derived from hey, resh, hey, hara, which means to receive a seed within oneself, which means in the hifil, hora, means to plant the seed in someone else, hence, to implant the seeds of truth and morality in others to teach. So Toros are the teachings which God has revealed to us of truth and goodness, which we are to accept in our minds and feelings, so as to beget in us the knowledge of truth and the decision to do good. So therefore, he says, the value of Toros are not in their doctrinal or theoretical character, but rather in their power that leads to action as a transforming agency in the lives of men. So let us begin the letter inside. Toros. The Toros call upon us to take to heart as principles that should govern our lives the truths revealed by history. So now, Rav Hirsch is going to go through many different psukim in order to prove to us that this is what Toros means. 1. That God is your God, the guide of your thoughts, feelings, words, and deeds, the mainspring of your whole life. And the pasuk quoted is, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, that I am Hashem who brought you out of Mitzrayim, and you should have no other gods before me. Next, that He is one, which challenges you to give thought to every aspect of your life, and to unite all of your faculties, means, and circumstances in the service and for the purposes of the One from whom they all derived. So over here we quote the pasuk Shema Yisrael, that we should have only one God, and that we should know that there are no other gods besides Hashem. We should be whole with Hashem our God. Tamim tiyeh im Hashem Elokecha. We should not have any type of graven images or any type of likeness, meaning no avodah zarah, and that we should have no nichosh, no soothsaying among us. Next, that all His creatures are His servants, and you too must join their ranks to labor in His service. So here we see psukim that show us that when we see the sun and the moon and the stars and all the hosts of heavens, that we might want to go and to worship these things. But then we have to know that we have Hashem that we worship, and we have to be whole with Hashem as He took us out of the Kor HaBarzel, out of Mitzrayim, and made us His people. Next, that His will was revealed to you for this purpose and for all times. Here we quote the pasuk that we have to guard ourselves very closely lest we forget what we saw in Mitzrayim, but rather v'hodatam livanecha v'livnei vanecha, we have to make sure that these things perpetuate from one generation to the next. And then Rav Hirsch quotes from Devarim, hey, pasuk yutes and on, where Moshe Rabbeinu discusses that when Bnei Yisrael saw Har Sinai and how scared they were of it, we said, behold, that Hashem has shown His glory and His greatness, and we heard His voice out of fire, and we have seen on this day that Hashem speaks to man, and that man could nevertheless live. And basically what they tell Moshe Rabbeinu is that you should go and speak to Hashem for us. Be our representative. And Moshe Rabbeinu ends off by saying, Mi yitein v'hayah levavam zeh lahem, that the people should always be like this. L'yirah osi v'lishmor es kol mitzvosai kol hayomim l'man yitav lahem v'livnehem le'olam. That we should always fear Hashem, always fear His commandments, which was the result of this revelation on the people. So continuing, and that your fate too should guide and educate you to this end. So here we quote the pasuk from Devarim Ches, pasuk Beis, V'zacharta es kol haderach asher holichecha Hashem Elokecha ze arba'im shana ba'midbar, leman anosecha l'nasosecha l'da'as es asher bilvavecha hasishmor mitzvosav im lo. That Hashem has tested us and guided us and afflicted us throughout the 40 years in the desert to see whether we would keep His commandments or not. Next, that the insight gained into God's greatness should lead you to the fear of God, the perception of His kindness, to love of God, and the recognition of His faithfulness, to trust in God. And Rav Hirsch quotes Psukim here from Devarim that says that we should beware lest we forget Hashem who brought us out of Mitzrayim, and that we should constantly have fear of Hashem, and we should serve Him. And then moving on, this is actually in Devarim Dalet, which is earlier, Pasuk Mem, that we should carefully keep all of the commandments, and that if we do so, things will go well with us and with our children, which will prolong our days on the earth. And then how we should not test Hashem, lo sinasu es Hashem elokeichem, that as we tested Him in this specific pasuk, talking about how we tested Hashem in Masa. And finally, the adata ki Hashem elokecha hu ho elokim, hokel Hane'emon, Shomer Habris Va'achesed Le'ohavav, L'Shomer Mitzvosav Le'elef Dor. Know that Hashem keeps His covenant and His mercy with those that love Him and keep His commandments for 1,000 generations. Next, that you are to ennoble your inner life so as to cleanse it of anything that might detract from your holy mission, divesting yourself of pride and lust. So first, looking at Psukim that deal with cleansing ourselves of anything that might detract us from our mission, we start by quoting the pasuk in Devarim Yud, pasuk Yud Beis, that says that Moshe Rabbeinu says to the people, what does Hashem ask you other than to fear Hashem and to walk in His ways, to love Him, to serve Hashem with all your heart and all your soul, and to keep the commandments that I have commanded you? And that Hashem owns everything in the entire universe, the earth, and everything that's in it. And how Hashem has loved our fathers and has chosen even us down to this day, and that we must sanctify ourselves because we are a holy people and Hashem is holy. We are His representatives here, and we shouldn't defile ourselves with a variety of different things. And the opposite, we have to actually need to go and make ourselves holy. V'yizkadishtem v'yisem kiddushim ki ani Hashem Elokeichem. And the fact that we are supposed to divest ourselves of pride and lust. So here Rav Hirsch quotes from Devarim Ches, Pasuk Yud Aleph and on, which discusses how when things are going well and everything is good, when you have houses and you've eaten and you have large flocks and lots of money, then you might come to forget Hashem who led you out of Mitzrayim, through the desert, etc. And a person might end up saying, Kochem ve'utzem yadi asali esachayil hazeh, that it's my power and my hands which have gotten me this wealth. But then the Torah says, V'zacharta, you should remember at that point that it's Hashem who has given you this power and this wealth, and that He established His covenant with our fathers. And finally, that you are to develop empathy with the pains and joys of all beings, and to embrace them all with love, because they are God's children. And here we quote from Devarim Tesvav, Psukim Zayin and Ches, that says that if there is a poor person among you, you should not harden your heart against your brother, but rather, Kifasoach tiftach es yadecha lo, you should open your hand, and you shall give your brother what he needs. And another pasuk from Vayikra, Yud Tes, that we are not allowed lo sikom velo sitores b'nei amecha v'yohavto l'reecha kamocha, that we must not bear grudge or take vengeance, but rather v'yohavto l'reecha kamocha, we shall love our brothers like we love ourselves. Ani Hashem, I am Hashem, who declares all these things. The Toros, then, are but a restatement for practical application of the truths that God reveals to us through His deeds. As principles of action, they are commanded, as ideas that are merely revealed, not imposed upon us. Whoever desires the truth will accept them. We're stating that these are revealed, not imposed upon us. We don't do this by belief in the existence of God, but rather by our knowledge of God. We do not do these fundamental mitzvahs based on faith, but rather on the revealed truths through our Mesorah that require us to act on them. And Diane Grunfeld, in his introduction, states as follows, "Here we meet with the conception of tradition in the Jewish sense of this word, as knowledge received by the nation in its totality and transmitted again and again to subsequent generations in their totality. This is in the last resort the meaning of the fundamental utterance of our sages that the souls of all of us stood at Sinai Mushba ve'omed mehar Sinai. Our knowledge of God is based on the evidence of our national community, and there is no need for us to arrive at a belief in the existence of God from the observation of nature and history. The reverse is true. With our knowledge of God, we look at nature and history. Thus, we see in nature and history the work of the God of our fathers. The relationship of the Jew to God is therefore not the outcome of a personal encounter in the sense of the modern Jewish existentialists. It is based on historical experience, whose uninterrupted tradition from one generation to another, vicarious experience, is the basis of our knowledge of God for all time to come. It is on this oral history that the fundamentals of Judaism rest. These considerations, however, do not exclude the deep and intimate personal relationship of the individual Jew to God at all times. The vital importance of this personal relationship to God in Jewish life and thought is stressed by Rav Hirsch in the opening pages of the Chorev." So at this point, we have ended our discussion of Toros. So let us continue with the category of Mishpatim. Once we have recognized the fundamental truths of the Torah through the Toros, so we need to place them into action. And the first way we do this is through Mishpatim, through justice. And the laws of justice are between man and his fellow. Now Rabbi Elias points out that we keep these laws of justice not being based on any sort of social consensus. We keep the Mishpatim of Hashem as God-given rules of the justice for mankind, meaning Hashem is the one who tells us what these rules of justice are. And at this point, I would like to see Diane Grunfeld's understanding of Mishpatim. So again, his explanations are a little bit long, but I think it's well worth it, especially if we want to get a good understanding of what each one of these categories actually means. Mishpatim. Under this heading, Rav Hirsch includes laws of justice towards human beings as our brothers and equals, children of the same father, placed in the world by him with the same claims on life. In reality, Mishpatim are the practical application of Toros in our lives. The concept of justice is for your conduct what the concept of the unity of God is for your mind. Justice is the guiding principle of our existence. All our duties are essentially laws of justice towards God, towards our fellow men, and towards beings subordinate to us, such as plants, animals, and the earth. The source of justice is God, just as He is the source of any conception of duty. In his later writings, Rav Hirsch constantly stressed the religious character of the very conception of law. This is all the more important because, to the modern mind, law and religion have little in common. They are almost considered as contrasts. Religion, the modern mind prefers to argue, belongs to the inner world of personal experience and feeling, whereas law belongs to the outer world of social organization. Religion springs from the desire to know God, whereas law is created and enforced by the state. In this view, law does not care about the peace of the soul and is indifferent to the spiritual side of life, while these are just the things religion is most concerned with. Legal sanctions, in the view of the modern lawyer, are incompetent to save a man's soul. All they can do is to prevent him from acting in a manner inimical to the welfare of society. The traditional Jewish view of the relationship of law and religion is quite different. For us, the law and religion are a unity. Law without religion lacks relation to the absolute, and religion without law necessarily deteriorates into ineffectual sentimentalism and loses its influence in the affairs of the world. And so both law and religion would fail in their true purpose, the sanctification of human life. To the Torah, law and religion are almost identical terms. Both have the same and equal authority, both being contained in the same revelation. Whereas the man-made laws of the secular states contain some justice in accordance with the limited faculties of man, the mishpatim of the Torah, being of divine origin, are absolute justice. The man-made laws of human society are based on utilitarian conceptions. At best, they are a compromise between the conflicting demands and interests of the various sections of society. Absolute justice is found only in the laws of God, the Mishpatim, as revealed in the Torah of Israel. He declared his word to Yaakov, his chukim and his Mishpatim to Israel. He has not dealt so with any nation, and even his Mishpatim they do not know. Those are two psukim in Tehillim. There can be no absolute justice without God. Thus the testament of our father Abraham enjoins his descendants that they may keep the way of the Lord to do righteousness and justice. As Rav Hirsch comments on this verse, a pure moral life before God is a preliminary condition and source for a truly just life of righteousness with our fellow men. The experience of the present epoch of history has shown that humanism without a religious basis, i.e., a humanism which denies that man was created in the image and likeness of God, will in the end destroy itself. And I assume he's referring to the Holocaust. Far from affirming man's self-confidence and creative power, and thus elevating man, an irreligious humanism is bound to debase man by ceasing to regard him as a being of a higher and divine origin. Worldly humanism must in the end become not only anti-religious, but anti-human. This remarkable phenomenon, which the Russian philosopher Berdyaev has called the self-destructive dialectic within humanism, was clearly foreseen by Israel's sages thousands of years ago when they uttered a warning against any attempt to base law and morality on anything else but a religious foundation. So let's see how Rav Hirsch discusses Mishpatim, and he begins by referring back to Toros. All these insights, however, are of value only if you truly live your life according to what you, as Mensch Yisrael in God's world, with your God-given powers, have recognized. So again, when he says all these insights, he refers to Toros, and then he goes directly into explaining Mishpatim. The first requirement is, therefore, that you practice justice. So the first category, he says, is respect every being in your surroundings, as well as everything within yourself, as a creation of your God. Next, respect whatever is theirs as given to them by God, or as having been acquired according to divinely sanctioned law. Let them keep or have whatever they are entitled by right to call their own. Do not be a source of harm to others. And the next one is, respect every human being as your equal. Respect him, his inner self, as well as his outer garment, his body, and his life. So here we begin by quoting some psukim, and we start with the Asar Sadibros, that a person is not allowed to covet his neighbor's house, his wife, his neighbor's servants, his ox. In other words, any of the possessions that a person has, or anything that a person owns, another person is not allowed to covet lo sachmod. And then we move on to the mitzvah that states that if there's any controversy between men, that they have to come to the judges, and the one who is correct will be judged to be righteous, and the one that is wicked will be condemned as the one who is wicked. And finally, Rav Hirsch quotes the pasuk that says, "Arur makeire ehu basaser," curses a person who smites his neighbor in secret. And this, of course, refers to respecting other people. Respect his property, too, as a legal extension of his body. So let's see the psukim on this. A person is not allowed to steal or to lie, to oppress his neighbor or to rob his neighbor. He has to pay a hired worker before the next morning or the end of the day. You have to respect your own property as well. If a thief is found tunneling in and you strike him down, you're not responsible. That's, of course, if a person is afraid he's going to be killed. And then Rav Hirsch gets into psukim that deal with a lot of monetary issues of robbery, dealing falsely with a person's neighbor regarding a deposit or a pledge, robbery, oppressing one's neighbor, person who swears falsely, and what one has to do in order to make reparations for this, both vis-a-vis man and vis-a-vis God. And finally, he quotes a pasuk, "Lo sa'ashok sachir aniva av yomei achacha umigarecha asher ba'artzecha bish'arecha," that you're not allowed to oppress a hired person who is poor and needy, whether he is of your brethren or a stranger that lives within your gates. Moving on to the next line, respect his claim to property or services that you have rendered to him. So over here we quote, halachos dealing with buying and selling. The Torah says, "Al tonu ish es achiv," you should not wrong each other. Again, halachos of reparations. If a person steals, he has to pay double. And it goes into more intricate details of things that are stolen, how you should fix that. And then finally, a person who borrows, who's responsible if something happens. So just to start the line over, respect his claim to property or services that you have to render to him. Properly measured or counted. So let's deal with that a little bit. It says that lo sa'asu ovel ba'mishpat, ba'mida, ba'mishkal, uva'misura. We have to make sure to do everything properly when it comes to weights and measures, etc. And the Torah warns us, lo yelecha v'chisecha even v'oven gedola uktana, that a person cannot have measures that are the wrong size. Continuing, as well as his claim to compensation for harm done to his body or property. And here we have some of the halachos of damages, that if I let my animal eat in someone else's field, I have to pay for it. Or if a fire breaks out, the person who caused the fire has to make restitution for that. What do you do if a person's animal damages another person? Or if a person goes and creates a pit in the road and causes damages to others, then how do you make restitution for that? The halachos that deal with if two people are fighting and one of them strikes the other one, what are the halachos involved there? And then finally, the last halacha he quotes is in Devarim Chaf Beis Ches, which discusses when you buy a house, if there is a place that needs a roof, a person must put a railing on it, so you should not bring damim beveisachal, you should not bring blood upon your house if a person would fall off of it. Respect his right to know the truth. The Torah warns us, midivar sheker tirchak. You have to keep far from anything that's false. The Torah warns us, lo tignovu v'lo sechachashu v'lo sishakaru ish ba'amiso. Again, you're not allowed to deal falsely or lie to one another. He continues, respect his right to know the truth and his right to freedom, happiness, peace of mind, honor, and a peaceful existence. So let's see what he refers to here for his right to freedom, happiness, and peace of mind. You're not allowed to oppress a ger, and the Torah reminds us, you were gerim in Mitzrayim. We are warned when there are gerim around, v'yohavta lo kamocha, you have to love him just like yourself. We're not allowed to warn each other, rather remember to fear God. And you're not allowed to hate your brother in your heart, but rather you have to rebuke your neighbor. If something's bothering you, you have to let him know. And honor and a peaceful existence. So what are the mitzvos involved in this? A person is not allowed to tell rechilos. He's not allowed to be a talebearer. And as far as peaceful existence goes, we're warned to stay away from the Mishkan, or in, I guess, later cases, the Mikdash. Anyone who is not a Kohen should not come close, because if he does, he could end up faring as Korach had. And finally, never abuse the frailty of his body, mind, or heart. We are not allowed to curse the deaf or put a stumbling block before someone who is blind. a person who makes a blind person go astray is cursed. And finally, never misuse your legal power over him. First, Moshe Rabbeinu comes and tells us that we should not be afraid, because Hashem comes to put his fear on you in order that you should not sin. A person's not allowed to utter a false report, and you should not join with the wicked to be a witness, an aid chamas. Lo satem mishpat avyonecha birivo. A poor person is allotted the same judgment as a rich man. We're strongly warned against giving any sort of shochad, any kind of gift, to someone who's judging a case, because such a thing blinds a person from judging correctly. Every case that's judged has to be done correctly. A person who is poor is not favored over one who's rich. One who's rich is not favored over one who's poor, but rather, b'tzedek tishpot am yisacha. Rather, the Torah commands us, shamoa bein achichem u'shvaten tzedek, bein ishu vein achiv uvein gero. The Torah says that the judge has to do righteously between a man and his brother, and with the stranger that is with him. So this concludes our discussion of Mishpatim, which finally brings us to Chukim. Now, Chukim are to be looked at as an extension of Mishpatim. However, instead of being for humans, for those that are on equal level with us, they are for animals, or so-called lesser beings, or beings of a lesser level. Yet they come from the same theme of justice that we've been discussing. Rabbi Elias explains that this explanation comes from the word chok, which can mean a portion, because each part of nature is due its portion of mishpat, of justice. And as we explained already, this explanation of Rav Hirsch is a contrast to the common understanding that chukim are those mitzvot that are beyond a human's understanding. Now, Diane Grunfeld's introduction to chukim, to the explanation of chukim, is very lengthy. However, it's definitely worth seeing it inside. So in the first paragraph that we're going to quote now, he explains what chukim are and how they're different from mishpatim. In consequence of the well-known passage of the Sifra, which we have quoted above, chukim are usually considered as irrational laws, as contrasted to mishpatim, which, owing to their rational character, would have been prescribed by human intelligence, even if the Torah had not prescribed them. In reality, however, both chukim and mishpatim can be traced back to a rational principle, namely the principle of justice. The difference is only that, whereas mishpatim are statements of justice towards men as our equals, chukim refers to things subordinate to us, including our own body. The same thoughtful regard which we must show to humans, we must show to all lower beings, to the earth which bears and sustains us all, to the world of the animals and plants, to our own body, our own mental faculties, our ego, which is most of all our own. What in the case of the mishpatim results from the concept of identical personality flows in the case of chukim from the fundamental notion of equal subordination to God. Our duties towards humanity are more intelligible to us because we have only to think of ourselves, our own views and feelings, in order to recognize and sympathize with the demands and needs of our fellow men. If we could put ourselves as thoroughly in the place of other things, if we could understand the nature and conditions of the interrelationships, combined activities, and essential unity of our own body and soul, we should find it easy to comprehend chukim, which are meant to rule all these relationships as we comprehend mishpatim. The Sifra rightly describes the mishpatim as laws which, even according to general human ideas, would be recognized as necessary and pertinent, and chukim as such against which our materialistic nature and the non-Jewish world, which is not trained in the conceptions of the Torah, rebel. At rock bottom, however, they are both, the one as much as the other, the expression of divine wisdom and justice. The difference between mishpatim and chukim is only this. The first are readily grasped by everyone, for they deal with the conditions of order in social life, which are apparent to all, whereas the matters and circumstances dealt with by the chukim, such as the combined inner spiritual and bodily nature of man and the resulting conditions of his sensual life in relation to his spiritual and moral summons are not clearly apparent to the human mind, but only to God our Maker. In reality, we know so very little of the inner relationship between body and mind. And so it came about that while the value of the Mishpatim was recognized by all, the Chukim were wrongly taken by the superficial judgment of non-Jewish and, alas, also Jewish thinkers to be without spiritual meaning or moral purpose. How right our sages were when they said more than 2,000 years ago that their Yetzer Hara and the nations of the world are opposed to the Chukim. In the next paragraph, Tayin Grunfeld now discusses the breakdown of mitzvos into shmilos and sichlios that we mentioned earlier, and what catastrophic results came about from this division of the mitzvos. The beginning of this development, which took a particularly deplorable turn after the Jewish emancipation and the rise of heretical movements within Jewry, can in a sense be traced back to the terminology of the medieval Jewish philosophers who called the Mishpatim laws of reason, Sichlios, and the Chukim laws of revelation, Shmios. It is true that neither Rav Sadigo nor his disciples ever thought of the possibility that their classification of laws could or would be taken to mean that the so-called revelation or ritual laws are or should be less binding on the Jew than the rational or moral laws, or likewise, that the latter, in spite of their rational character, should be considered as of other than divine character. But by Rav Hirsch's day, things had changed. The medieval classification of our laws into rational and revelational was translated by the reformers into moral and ceremonial laws, and this terminological exactitude has wrought havoc in Jewish life. The so-called moral laws were considered as of permanent value, representing the spiritual core of the Jewish legislation, whereas the ceremonial laws were considered as the outward shell which, being only stimulating forms suitable to the times, could be discarded at will as long as the inward frame of mind and the right attitude, or way of thinking, is actually a German word there, but I believe that's the translation, of the Jew was kept intact. And although every page of the Torah is a living protest against this conception, it nevertheless spread to an alarming degree in post-emancipation Jewry and is unfortunately widely held to this very day. Small wonder, then, that Rav Hirsch not only attacked the term ceremonial and ritual laws as completely misleading, but also declared in his famous controversy with Geiger that there was little meaning or reality to the classification of our laws by the medieval Jewish philosophers into laws of reason and laws of revelation. In his publication, Rav Hirsch showed in detail how many of the so-called rational laws cannot by any means be justified through the human intellect. Now in the next paragraph, Tayin Grunfeld discusses another reason why Mishpatim and Chukim cannot be understood as moral and ceremonial laws. The conception that Mishpatim are moral laws and Chukim ceremonial laws is misleading also for a different reason. The aim of the Chukim is to limit our sensual desires. Chief among the Chukim are the dietary laws and the laws of sexual morality, in connection with which the Torah itself continually stresses the aspect of holiness, in other words, moral perfection based on the freedom of the human will, even in the face of the strongest sensual urges. From this alone, it can be seen how wrong it is to consider the Chukim as mere ceremonies in contrast to the moral laws. In this connection, so Rav Hirsch points out, it is of special interest that the first law addressed to man in the Torah, namely the prohibition against eating of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, was a dietary law and a typical chok. With this prohibition, a chok in optima forma, the education of man for his moral and high godly calling begins. Now, Dayan Grunfeld discusses why Chukim and Mishpatim are mentioned together very often, and why Chukim are almost always mentioned before Mishpatim. In his later writings, Rav Hirsch repeatedly calls attention to the fact that Chukim and Mishpatim are usually mentioned together, and that Chukim are mostly mentioned first, with some exception. There is a deep reason for this order. The Chukim, which deal with the character training of man, are a prerequisite to the Mishpatim, the social laws, which are based on man's being able to control himself. The purer the body, the clearer will the image of God in it come to be realized, as long as the body submits itself to the spirit. That the so-called ceremonial laws have the same aim as the moral laws is also evident from the fact that the most typical moral law, namely the law that you should love your neighbor as yourself, appears in the Torah in juxtaposition with a typical ceremonial law, namely, you shall not wear shatnez, wool and linen together. Rav Hirsch's explanation of the Chukim is one of his greatest achievements in the search for the underlying spirit of Jewish laws. He clearly connected the Chukim with the sphere of moral philosophy and the conception of holiness. This has special reference to the laws of purity and impurity, the dietary laws, and the laws of sexual morality. Other chukim, such as the prohibition of certain kinds of mixture, shatnez and kalayim, and the rule as to meat and milk, basar b'chalav, he traced back to the great principle of limino, that man should not interfere with the order and harmony of creation. As Rav Hirsch considered the chukim to be laws aiming at the holiness of the body as being the instrument of the soul, he rejected on principle any hygienic explanations as well as any attempt to explain them merely as protection against idolatrous practices of antiquity. Now the first one, the fact that it's against hygienic explanations, that was a favorite of reform. For example, they said that we cannot eat meat of a pig because of trigonosis. But once you know that if you cook the animal a certain amount of time and that's not a problem anymore, then it's mutter. So that's something that the reform movement was very into in its beginning, at least. And you see where that led, as reform doesn't really keep much in terms of kosher at all. And secondly, to say that the chukim are against idolatrous practices, so that's something that the Rambam uses in his Mor Nevuchim again and again and again. There are, I mean, I don't want to say how many mitzvos because I don't know a specific number, but there are many, many mitzvos that he explains the whole mitzvah away by just saying, well, it was put in there just to go against idolatrous practices of the time. He rightly held that such explanations are capable of undermining the concept of the eternal validity of the chukim. And then in the next paragraph, Diane Grunfeld points out that in spite of all this, the Rav Hirsch never lost sight that such meditations upon the mitzvos, however appealing they are really just hypotheses. And that if we could say this in regard to Tamei HaMitzvos in general, then we should specifically apply this to the chukim. And that the ultimate validity of these mitzvos is not based on any of our speculation or our ability to understand any of the mitzvos, but rather because the pasuk says, Kol mitzvosecha emunah, that the real foundation of all our laws is the conviction of their divine origin, and that's it. We do the mitzvos just because Hashem commanded them. That is what our sages intended to express when they said in regard to the chukim, perhaps you might say that these laws are vain. That is why the Torah adds, I am the Lord. I have ordained these laws, and it does not behove your limited understanding to query their value or your duty to obey them. There is no better paraphrase to this Talmudical passage than the majestic lines with which Rav Hirsch concludes his exposition of the dietary laws, which are such a typical example of all chukim. High above all human speculation stands the Torah, the law of Israel's life, eternal and immutable, like the laws by which the planets move in the sky and the grain of the seed grows in the soil. The same God who laid down the law which nature of necessity follows also pronounced the law which Israel is asked to follow of its own free will. And just as the laws of nature are unchangeable, despite any opinion man may hold, so all speculations on the laws of the Torah can only be an enlightenment of our own minds, but never the cause of their validity. For the causa causorum of the laws of nature, as well as the laws of the Torah, is God. So while this explanation of Rav Hirsch might be a chiddush, upon reflection, it fits beautifully into our understanding of the mitzvos and places the chukim in the realm of man's understanding. So we are finally ready to see Rav Hirsch's words inside. Chukim, the same justice that you owe to man should be shown to every lower being, from the earth which bears everything, to vegetation and the animal world, to your own body, your mental powers, your own self that, more than anything else, you can call yours. in the case of Mishpatim, the demand for justice is based upon the equality of all men, whereas here, it derives from the principle that everything belongs to God, who represents its interests against your arbitrariness. The demands of Mishpatim are clearer to you, because to a large extent, you only need to know your own feelings in order to identify with the feelings of your fellow men. If you had the same knowledge of your body and your mind, and the conditions for their harmonious interaction, and if you were able to put yourself also into the place of any other creature, then chukim would be as intelligible to you as mishpatim. The chukim require of you respect for all that exists as God's property. Do not destroy anything. Do not misuse it. Do not waste. Use everything wisely. So here Rav Hirsch quotes the pasuk that when you go and make war in a city, you should not destroy the fruit-bearing trees that are around the city in order to lay siege to that city. And further, we're told in Vayikra Chaf Beis Chaf Dalad that you are not allowed to needlessly destroy an animal. Respect for all the species. Their order was established by God. Do not intermingle them. So here we're given mitzvos of kilayim, in terms of animals, in terms of plants, in terms of shatnez, in terms of the vineyard. We are warned not to allow an ox and a donkey to plow together, not to wear wool and linen, which come from two different types of species, one being an animal and the other one being a plant. And we are warned for basar b'chalav not to cook a gidi b'chalev imo, a kid in its mother's milk. Respect for all creatures. They are servants in the household of creation. So here Rav Hirsch quotes the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKein, and the Torah also warns us not to kill an animal and its young on the same day. Respect for the feelings and instincts of animals. The Torah tells us that if you see your enemy that has his donkey which is loaded, you should help him unload his animal, even though you hate him. The Torah enjoins us not to muzzle an ox when it's threshing the field. Respect for the human body, even after the soul has departed. The Torah tells us that if someone is put to death, they must hang his body up, yet his body is only left hanging for a very brief amount of time and then it's taken down. Respect for your own body. Maintain it as it is the repository, messenger, and instrument of the spirit. We are warned in the Torah not to cut ourselves, not to make any sort of baldness between your eyes, which were things that were done by different nations for their dead. But we don't do that when it comes to our dead. We are not allowed to make any marks on our skins, such as tattooing or things of the like. Moving on, limitation of your own instincts and animal-like actions. Subordinate them to God's law so that truly human and sanctified, they can help you attain the holy goal of mankind and will not turn you into a mere animal. The Torah warns us when we go to war, which is especially a time when passions can run high, that a person who's not Tohar, he should stay out of the camp. We are warned that when a person needs to go to the bathroom, he must have a shovel with him in order that he should cover over when he needs to go to the bathroom. And why is that? Ki Hashem Elokecha misaleich b'karav machanecha, because God is in the midst of your camp in order to deliver you from your enemies. And v'hoya machanecha kadosh, therefore, your camp must be holy. And there should be no ervas davar, any sort of unseemly thing among you, because that would cause Hashem v'shav me'acharecha to turn away from you. A man and a married woman who willingly live together, they're given the death penalty. If she's not married, but she was forced into this, then there are certain damages that he must pay. In Vayikra Yud Ches, the Torah goes through all of the arayos, who you are not allowed to live with. And included among this is the Isser of Molech, which is a type of idol worship, and also the Isser of homosexuality, as well as bestiality. These are all things that the Torah says we must stay very far away from, because if you will do these things, all the nations that lived here in the land before you did all these things, and what happened? Hashem threw them out of the land. Respect for your soul. When you nourish its tool, the body, supply the body only with such nourishment that will enable it to act as a pure and willing messenger of the world to the spirit, and of the spirit to the world, rather than giving it food that will induce sluggishness and sensuality. So first, Rav Hirsch quotes the entire Vayikra Yud Aleph. He actually doesn't quote any of these, he references them. But the entire Vayikra Yud Aleph deals with the animals we are allowed and not allowed to eat. We are warned not to eat chelev, types of fat, which are usser. We are warned against eating blood, and not to eat anything which is considered abominable. Again, in Devarim Yudalah, the Torah goes through the laws of what we are allowed and not allowed to eat among the animals. We are also given mitzvos that include bringing up our grain, the first of our grain, and the first of trees, etc., that we eat those in Yerushalayim, and the bechoros of your animals as well. And why do we do all this? L'man tilmal liyira'es Hashem alokacha kol hayomim. In order that we should learn to fear Hashem. Similarly, we have a system of meiser, of taxes, that we give to the Kohanim and the Levim. Skipping over a lot of them, because a lot of them are repetitive, in terms of our purpose at least. Anything that died on its own without the proper shechita, we're not allowed to eat, but rather, we cast it to the dogs. L'kelev tashlichuno so. And again, the Torah warns us repeatedly, again and again, to stay away from eating dam, from eating blood. Concealment and sublimation of the animal in you, rather than according it too much respect and attention, only thus will the conflict within you ultimately be resolved, and the animal in you will also aspire only to the truly human. So again, we're told to bring the first fruits of the harvest to the Kohen. We're warned not to cut our peos and our beards in specific ways that we're enjoined not to do. Also included in this are some of the laws of kashrus regarding how to take a vessel which was used for non-kosher and to make it kosher. And finally, the prohibition of cross-dressing. A man is not allowed to wear a woman's clothing, and a woman is not allowed to wear a man's clothing. Why is that? Kisoavas Hashem alokacha kol ose eila. Because whoever does these things, Hashem considers it an abomination. And finally, lastly, respect for your own person in its purest expression, your power of speech. So we know when a person makes a vow, makes a neder, that this vow has a Torah prohibition attached to it of breaking your word. It's a very serious thing for a Jew, or for anyone for that matter, to break their vow. And just an interesting note, the very last pasuk Rav Hirsch quotes here is actually from Bilam. Hine vorech lakachti uverech v'lo ashivenu. That when Bilam is bidden to bless us, he may not take it back. That's what Hashem declares. That's what must happen. So presumably this is when Bnei Yisrael is doing what they're supposed to be doing and properly doing, then this blessing will come to us. When it's not, then unfortunately the opposite might be true. So this concludes our discussion of the Chukim. So just to wrap it up, we see that Toros, Mishpatim, and Chukim are all related, and they serve the same general purpose, but in different ways. Each one grows on the other, or into the other. They're all considered first requirements of a Jew, and this ends letter 11.